This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. We are now just hours away before a planned summit between U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva. Expectations for a major breakthrough at the June 16th summit are low, with ties between Washington and Moscow at their most strained in years. Both leaders say they hope the Geneva meeting, their first in-person encounter since Biden became president, can lead to stable and predictable relations, even though they remain at odds over everything from Ukraine to Syria. Israeli aircraft carried out a series of airstrikes at militant sites in the Gaza Strip, the first such raids since a shaky ceasefire ended the war with Hamas militants last month. The Israeli airstrikes targeted facilities used by Hamas for meetings to plan attacks, according to the military, blaming the militant group for any act of violence emanating from Gaza. There were no immediate reports of casualties. On Tuesday, hundreds of Israeli ultranationalists, some chanting death to Arabs, paraded in East Jerusalem in a show of force that threatened to spark renewed violence. The outgoing UN Special Envoy for Yemen has expressed a deep regret to the Security Council that he failed to mediate a ceasefire and peace talks between Yemen's warring parties during the past 3 years. But Martin Griffiths said Tuesday he hopes that diplomatic efforts, especially by Oman, will bear fruit, despite painting a bleak picture of the Arab world's poorest country in his final briefing to the council. Griffiths said the country is in the throes of the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and people are forced to live under violence, insecurity, and fear, with limits to their freedom of movement, religion, and free expression. This is VOA News. In consecutive visits this month, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas have conveyed to the most important U.S. partner that the Biden administration is taking a nuanced approach to immigration than its predecessor, but still asking what more Mexico can do. Mayorkas said Tuesday at the conclusion of 2 days of high-level meetings that they've challenged one another with respect to what more can each do to address the level of irregular migration that has persisted for several months. In May, encounters with migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border inched up from April to more than 180,000. A top Army leader is defending the Pentagon's response to the January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The Lieutenant General Walter Piatt told the House panel Tuesday that the National Guard was delayed for hours because it had to properly prepare for the deployment. He also said senior military leaders had determined beforehand that there was no role for the U.S. military in determining the outcome of an American election. He is a director of the Army staff. The January 6 riots were supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the building in order to stop the certification of now President Joe Biden's victory. The U.S. death toll from COVID-19 has now exceeded 600,000, even as the vaccination drive has slashed daily cases and deaths and allowed the country to emerge from the gloom. That is according to the toll recorded by Johns Hopkins University. The number of lives lost is greater than the population of the cities of Baltimore and Milwaukee. It is about equal to the number of Americans who died of cancer in 2019. Hungarian lawmakers have now approved legislation that prohibits sharing with minors any content that portrays or promotes homosexuality or sex reassignment. The National Assembly passed the bill Tuesday on a 157-1 vote. Most opposition parties boycotted the voting session to protest what they denounced as discrimination against LGBT people. Hungary's conservative ruling party introduced the legal changes last as part of a bill aimed at fighting pedophilia. The amendments that ban the representation of any sexual orientation besides heterosexual and any sex reassignment information in school sex education programs or in films and advertisements aimed at anyone under 18. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A suicide bomber killed at least 10 Somali army recruits on Tuesday.
The attack would be in response to the ongoing military operation and to disrupt the stability of major cities designated to host the upcoming elections.
Arab League foreign ministers tried to resolve the Nile River dam conflict between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. Kenya strives to eradicate blindness causing trachoma. The ILO reports worsened conditions for domestic workers. And Zambia's Electoral Commission suspends the campaigns of the ruling party and the main opposition in four districts.
Over the weekend, there were reports of violence which were confirmed by the Zambia police in the district court in Pulungu in northern Zambia, and the commission had no option but to suspend the political party campaigns for these two political parties.
And the Dakar Music Expo is back this week after being sidelined due to coronavirus. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somalia's army chief says a suicide bomber on Tuesday killed at least 10 recruits and wounded 20 others at a military training school in the capital, Mogadishu. The Al-Shabaab terror group claimed responsibility in a statement and has stepped up attacks ahead of elections expected by the end of July. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
The attack happened Tuesday outside General Dagabadhan military training school south of the capital, Mogadishu. A suicide bomber who disguised himself as one of the recruits detonated his explosives as trainees were gathering for a security screening. Army Chief General Odawar Rage told the state media that 10 recruits lost their lives and 20 others were wounded and taken to various health facilities in the city. In a statement, militant group Al-Shabaab said that one of its fighters was responsible for the attack. The group said the attack happened inside heavily fortified Turkish-built military base. It put the casualty at total 40 dead and 50 wounded. This latest attack comes days after the army said an operation in the Middle Shabelle and Hiran regions killed 50 Al-Shabaab fighters. According to security expert Ahmed Hassan, the militants are responding to the increased pressure from the military.
So the attack would be in response to the ongoing military operation and to disrupt the stability of major cities designated to host the upcoming elections. A third intention could also be to discourage young citizens from joining the National Army. As you might be aware, we have recently observed an increase in high school graduates, in young men and women voluntarily subscribing to the army.
Somali security agencies, backed by their international partners, have beefed up the security across the country ahead of the presidential and parliamentary elections slated to take place in 2 months. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Arab League foreign ministers met on Tuesday in Qatar, focusing on efforts to resolve the Nile River dam conflict between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. Egypt's foreign minister, Samir Shoukry, says Cairo is seeking a diplomatic and not a military solution to its crisis with Ethiopia over the filling of the Renaissance Dam on the Nile River, set to begin at the start of next month. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
بالنسبة للتحرك العربي في أزمة سد النهضة اليوم كان صدر قرار عن الاجتماع.
Arab League head Ahmed Abul Ghait and Qatar's foreign minister Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman bin Jassim Al Thani talked to journalists Tuesday after Arab League foreign ministers met in Doha. They said the group is calling on the UN Security Council to take up the water dispute between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. The League is trying to prevent a conflict when Ethiopia begins to fill the Grand Renaissance Dam again next month, despite the absence of a water use agreement with Egypt and Sudan. Mediation efforts by the African Union have not made any tangible progress, and both Egypt and Sudan have expressed concern that their national security will be adversely affected if Ethiopia proceeds with filling the dam. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry told Arab media Monday that Cairo is still trying to exhaust all diplomatic channels with Ethiopia before resorting to other means. He says Egypt is trying to reach a solution within the current negotiating framework, but if it fails and there is damage or a threat to the lives of Egyptians or Sudanese, then both countries have a responsibility to defend and protect their people. Sudan's irrigation minister, Yasser Abbas, told a press conference Monday in Khartoum his country would approve the filling of the dam if Ethiopia enters into a binding agreement with both Sudan and Egypt. He says Sudan is ready to accept a step-by-step agreement with Ethiopia if it will sign an accord including everything that has been agreed upon until now, including a guarantee that negotiations will continue within a finite period of time. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who repeatedly has insisted the filling of the dam will continue as scheduled at the start of July, said recently his country was not trying to use the dam to pressure its neighbors. He says the dam is a sign of Ethiopia's independence, and through it, we affirm that we have no behind-the-scenes colonialist project to use against our neighbors. He added that Ethiopia is a proud, independent country and will continue to be so forever. Egyptian political analyst Said Sadik tells VOA that Ethiopia's ruling party has been using the dam negotiations for internal political considerations, including uniting disparate ethnic factions within the country and rallying support for ahead of upcoming elections. He also believes Egyptian leaders will exhaust diplomatic means before taking more forceful action.
Egypt is hesitant to jump into a war before fulfilling all the diplomatic channels so that anything that is done, at least we have legitimate international coverage. Or we went through the channels of solving the international problems peacefully and we have failed.
Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University in Washington, tells VOA this is a very delicate and treacherous moment for negotiations and that the situation could become inflamed if Ethiopia tries to fill the dam too quickly, causing water shortages in Egypt and Sudan. The situation is coming to a head, and what happens in the next few weeks could determine a lot, he adds. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Zambia's Electoral Commission on Tuesday banned all campaigns by the ruling Patriotic Front Party and the opposition United Party for National Development, UPND Alliance, in Lusaka and three other districts. The ban does not affect other political parties and independent candidates. It follows an uptick in election-related violence in recent weeks. While some Zambians welcome the suspension, others say a presidential campaign without festive rallies, particularly by the two leading parties, defeats the whole purpose of a democratic campaign. Zambia's Electoral Commission spokesperson, Patricia Luanga, says the commission had no choice but to ban the campaigns of the two leading parties. She says the parties have 2 weeks to curb the violence, but if they do not, the commission may impose additional restrictions, including disqualification.
During this campaign period, you know that the respective political parties are given an opportunity by the commission for a period of 3 months to sell their various manifestos to the electorate. But what we have witnessed in the past weeks are spats of violence in some selected of the country. And Lusaka, the capital, has not been spared. Last week on Friday, the commission issued this statement to caution the political parties involved, and that's the Patriotic Front, which is the ruling party, and we also have the opposition United Party for National Development. We did caution them to the fact that the commission would not hesitate to invoke the Electoral Process Act and the Code of Conduct should the two political parties continue engaging in violent activities. Now, James, I need to quickly mention to you that we've got 16 political parties that have fielded presidential candidates. We are not hearing any violent activities from them. It's just the two political parties, the UPND and the Patriotic Front. Even after sending that caution to them on Friday, over the weekend, there were reports of violence which were confirmed by the Zambia police in the district court in Pulungu in northern Zambia, and the commission had no option but to suspend the political party campaigns for these two political parties in order for them to be able to go back to the drawing board and rethink their campaign strategies. And probably if we see any change in the coming 14 days, we may lift the suspension. If they do not change, if they continue with violent activities, the commission will take extra decisions as well as measures that might even end up in disqualification.
Patricia, what does the commission say to those Zambians who are saying, why not postpone the election if you think there's violence? After all, they argue, what is an election without campaigns?
We totally understand, and that is why, by law, the commission is compelled to provide 90 days or 3 months to allow the political parties to campaign. But also remember that the commission is charged with the responsibility by the Constitution of the Republic of Zambia to discharge all electoral activities and campaigns inclusive. So if you have been given a platform as a political party to sell your manifesto, where we sit, we don't see it as an opportunity for you to go and wreak havoc in the community. People are living in fear because they're instilling that sense of fear in them. So why should you come back and say the commission is not being fair when in the actual sense what you're doing is sowing violence? And we have said as a commission, violence does put the credibility of any election result into question. And we do not want any electorate, anyone across the region or the globe to come back and say Zambia had violent campaigns preceding the election, and so the credibility of the election is questioned. We do not want that to happen.
You mentioned the ban in Lusaka and I think three other districts. The argument is that these are probably urban areas and they normally support the opposition UPND alliance. So what about the question that perhaps this ban may disadvantage the opposition?
We usually laugh at the commission when we hear these strongholds. For us, as far as we are concerned, we don't see any stronghold for any political party. Remember, we are very independent, very impartial in the way we see things and in the way we do things. So when we are brought into conversations of this is an opposition stronghold, this is the ruling party stronghold, we do not condone that because all we see are electorate. In fact, if you are speaking about the presidential election, Zambia is the constituency. It's not Mpulungu, it's not Namwala, it's not Nakonde, it's not Lusaka, but the entire country that votes for the president. So we will not even speak to that because we don't even see it. What we have done, and it is on record, there have been violent activities that have been recorded in these districts. And as a control measure to safeguard the peace of the nation and the lives of the people, we've simply moved in accordance with the law. That gives us the mandate to regulate and handle all electoral-related issues. We've moved in to create sanity in the process.
Patricia, thank you very much again for talking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much for having the Electoral Commission of Zambia, and we look forward to more interactions with you.
Patricia Luanga is the spokesperson of the Electoral Commission of Zambia. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 16. The International Labour Organization, the ILO, says 10 years after the landmark Convention on Domestic Workers was adopted, working conditions for millions have not improved. A new report assessing the situation finds that conditions for many domestic workers have been made worse by the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
When the convention was adopted a decade ago, domestic workers were among the most undervalued, invisible members of the global workforce. 10 years later, domestic workers still struggle to be seen and recognized as people who provide an essential service. Data in the ILO report show the world's 75.6 million domestic workers continue to suffer from poor working conditions, low pay, and a lack of social protection. It finds for many, the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened their already difficult situation. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says domestic workers have lost their jobs or had their hours of work reduced in greater numbers than others during the pandemic. He notes many domestic workers are migrants, so their status in the country could be called into question if they lost their jobs.
Many domestic workers live in employees. They could lose their lodgings where they live if they lose their job as well. So behind the aggregated numbers, I think there is a sort of a deeper human impact which accentuates even more the suffering involved in the labour market impact on them of the COVID-19 pandemic.
The ILO reports domestic work remains a female-dominated sector, accounting for three-quarters of domestic workers worldwide. Ryder says women comprise more than 80% of those working in the informal sector, which makes them more prone to exploitation and abuse.
Informal employment is characterized by poor working conditions, a lack of protection, and so we find that the vulnerability of many domestic workers earning their living behind closed doors in private households is that vulnerability is magnified by this condition of informality.
Ryder says the crisis highlights the need to formalize domestic work to ensure their access to decent work and laws that can protect their rights. The report finds women make up most of the workforce in Europe, Central Asia, and in the Americas. However, it notes men outnumber women in Arab states and in North Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenyan authorities are working to eradicate trachoma, an infectious disease that is a leading cause of blindness in Africa. As Brenda Molinya reports from Nairobi, about 7 million people in central Kenya are at risk for the disease.
As Elizabeth Patote sits outside a clinic in Kajiado County in Kenya, she stares unseeingly into the dry and brittle spaces outside the health facility. In a few minutes, a surgeon will carry out a corrective eye operation and allow the more than 70-year-old woman to see clearly for the first time in over a decade. She is one of thousands of people in Kenya who have either lost or are gradually losing their sight due to trachoma. She says, "My eyes have been bothering me because I have grown old. The lashes are always getting into my eyes, causing me a lot of pain. My granddaughter has been helping, removing them physically with her fingers, but it is very painful." Trachoma, an infectious disease, is caused by a bacteria that attack the inner surfaces of the eyelids. Dr. Peter Ekwom, an eye surgeon who has been carrying out trachoma surgeries in Kajiado County, says sight loss from trachoma is preventable but irreversible if not treated in time.
Every time you blink, the eyelashes rub on the corneas. And with the time, they peel off the first layer of the cornea, which results to an ulcer. Now, the ulcer is very painful, but at the end of the day, the ulcer will heal and leaves a scar.
That repeated scarring of the eye's cornea eventually impairs vision and often leads to irreversible blindness. About 7 million people live in 12 central Kenyan counties where trachoma is endemic because of a dry climate and the pastoral and nomadic lifestyle there. About 53,000 people are currently infected with the disease. Like other countries affected by trachoma, Kenya had wanted to eliminate it by 2020, the World Health Organization's target. The target date has now been moved to 2023. Dr. Ernest Baraza, Kenya's National Trachoma Coordinator, explains.
So the way forward for the Kenya Trachoma Elimination Program is to clear the remaining trachoma trichiasis backlog, which stands at around 5,000 at the moment. That is 5,000 people who require urgent surgery to avert blindness in the 12 trachoma endemic counties.
To eradicate trachoma, experts say people in areas prone to the disease must take greater precautions. Most of the communities at risk are nomadic, sometimes living with their livestock.
Flies breed because of the dung and urine. And then because the flies are breeding, every time there is a discharge in a child's face, the bacteria is carried from the child to the mother.
Kenya's plans to defeat trachoma depends on donors for the money for detection, treatment and prevention programs. Only with more contributions, Kenya says, will it be able to eliminate the disease. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
After being sidelined due to coronavirus restrictions earlier this year, the Dakar Music Expo is back this week for its second edition. Dudu Saar, the founder of the expo, talks to Ricky Stryak about how his years as Yusuf Ndour's manager and agent influenced his decision to launch a music festival in Dakar.
And of course, going around the world, you see similar events all over the place, and you think, but why not Dakar? Hence, Dakar Music Expo. We thought that Dakar would be a beautiful city to host something like that, that, you know, similar to Midem in Cannes or South by Southwest in Austin in Texas.
How many years has the Dakar Music Expo been going on?
Well, it's still in its infancy, I would say. I mean, I'm still on my pilot edition. My friends kind of tease me, say, dude, is always, you know, this is a pilot edition. Well, basically, we started just before COVID, thank God for that. That was, well, I don't know about that, actually, because I spent a lot of my savings on the first edition. We started January 2020, and of course, you know, the rest is history. So this is the second edition, and I must say, I must stress that the month that we normally hold is end of January, beginning of February.
Because it is a bit interesting timing, given the Jazz Fest that's going on in Saint Louis. Have you run into any constraints with that?
Well, in a perfect world, I mean, we could have both. But you know, in any country, you have, like in France, you've got multiple festivals going around and artists touring. So if we're looking at it from a touring perspective and being able to do two cities in one country, then that's fine. But I think we haven't got that far yet. So I think a little bit of talking amongst the promoters, and that's why we're convening. That's why we're gathering the professionals to set up that calendar of events.
And the music is quite different, obviously. And you've got everyone from Orchestra Baobab to Awadi curating a show. What do you think is, and is there a new group that you're excited about that maybe will get some bigger, wider recognition?
I think it balanced out very well between the old and known talent like Orchestra Baobab and DJ Awadi. And I think that also gives it its sort of credibility. But, you know, every day I'm looking forward to, I've programmed all the groups. I'm particularly keen on Thursday, the opening, because it's the stage is set for all the sort of female bands, because we're, you know, championing women musicians on Thursday. And also on Friday, I mean, one of my favorites is the Africa Remix Orchestra, which is a band made up of musicians from all around Africa, and they all live in Dakar, which again is a testimony of. So yeah, but I'm particularly looking forward to Orchestra Jigeni's performance on Thursday, and Tifa, which is who's a young lady from Mauritania who's now set up shop in Dakar.
That was Dudu Saar, founder of the Dakar Music Festival. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, June 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.